much. Dr. Dobbs said it can't be.
Thank you. I'd like to thank everyone for inviting me here, and I'm very happy to talk about Google and Linux. Love to do that. As he said, I think Google probably doesn't need much of an introduction to most of you, but if there are a few people out there who don't know Google, we are a search engine, and we've been in business a little over 2 years. We started out as a very tiny search engine, just doing a few queries here and there. And in my presentation, I'll lead you through the history of Google and where we are now and what our cluster is doing for fun and hopefully for profit. First of all, why should you use Google? There are lots of search engines out there. So I did a little comparison 2 days ago. I did this on Wednesday. And I took Alta Vista and compared it to Google. You actually can't see, but it says Alta Vista here. Unfortunately, they chose light blue on dark blue, which doesn't show up well here. But that is Alta Vista. And I did a search, one word, Usenix. Popular search. What I'd like to point out about what Google shows you is, first of all, we come up with the Usenix.org homepage as our first hit. Contrasting that with Alta Vista, they come up with the Glimpse manual page. Not as relevant as I would like. Another thing is we pride ourselves and make it a goal that every search is completed in under half a second. And in fact, you can see in this one that this search took 0.06 seconds. And this was not a doctored slide at all. I literally just did the search and saw what it came back. And I actually did it during peak hours when we had our most traffic. A couple other things about what Google shows. First of all, we also show you the categories here. So if you want to go into our Open Directory and look, you can see where, in fact, Usenix fits in that. And obviously it fits in, computer science. You don't really get that same thing from Alta Vista, of course. We give the little snippets beneath the link there that says Unix Association homepage, and it'll let you know when you have a page of 10 results whether that actually is a page that you're interested in using or not. And often the snippet can contain the very information you need, and you don't even have to click on the link. Especially if you're looking for something that, if you're looking for a particular number or a fact, if you type in the right keyword or keywords, often the snippet might even say, exactly what you want. You don't even have to click on the link. So the snippets are very useful. We also have something that is unique in that we cache the pages. And you can see the cached link there. And if for some reason the Usenix.org site is down, not that it ever would be, but some sites have been known to not be available at certain times or another, or if the page is no longer in existence, we cache the page on our Google servers, and you can get a copy of it by clicking on that cached link. It goes to our servers, retrieves the page. There's a little header at the top that says that here's the date we downloaded this page. It probably does not represent the current page, but here's the way it was, the snapshot, so to speak, when we downloaded it, when we crawled it. That's a very useful feature when you can't find a site's down. We also have the feature of similar pages. So if you're looking for similar organizations or whatnot, interestingly, you will see that Alta Vista has related pages. That is something that is new for them. They actually copied that from us within the past few months. They did not have that before then. So I think that they're starting to take note of the fact that Google, who really is a search engine and a search engine only. We're not a portal. We don't do mail. We don't do chat. We don't do streaming this, audio that. We're just a search engine, and that's a viable business model. And AltaVista is starting to catch on to that, and they're starting to copy us, as are some others. The PR department makes me put this slide up. So you can all read that we've won some awards. We've actually won hundreds of awards, but we don't have space for them, and there's really not much to say about it. People like us. Here are some of our web and site search partners. As many of you may have heard, in July, we replaced InkMe as Yahoo's default search engine. For over a year, we've been Netscape's default search engine. We power sites like Caldera, VMware, and Red Hat, and Cisco. And what site search is what we do is we crawl a particular domain, Cisco, Caldera, Red Hat, VMware, at the frequency that that company desires. Often it's nightly. And when you go to their site, you do a search, and it just has a little search box and a little Google logo next to it, and you do the search. It comes to our computers so that that company has to devote no resources at all, other than paying us, of course. The days of dot-coms and no profits are over, I think. They pay us, and that's the only resource they devote to search. None of their computers are involved in the search at all. We crawl their computers, we do all the indexing, and we store all the data, and we cache the pages on our servers. So if their site is down, you can still get the information from us directly. The others you can see, Washington Post. We do both site search for them and also general web search. The logo there doesn't particularly show it. It says web search there, but also you can do a site search that is restricted to only the Washington Post pages. And for a new site like that, the site search is actually particularly important because obviously their content changes dynamically every day. Yeah. And so to have us crawl it every evening and re-index it. So an article comes out this afternoon saying that the conference was a huge success, and it's a front-page story. It's searchable on their site through us the next morning. A couple other partners, Nextel. We do wireless searches, so if you have WAP-enabled phones, you can do searches on Google. And NetEase is a large Chinese portal. These are just some of our over 100 partners that we have right now. Our corporate overview. Larry Page and Sergey Brin are our two co-founders. They were PhD students at Stanford, and in the mid-1990s, they were working on data mining, information retrieval, and database management. And what they came up with was a way to look at the link structure of web pages in combination with the keywords and come up with a way to rank the pages and make it relatively spam-proof so people can't put in lots of keywords in meta tags or invisible text or other things to fool the search engines that were currently working at the time and being fooled and spammed. They were very happy. They had a couple PCs running Linux under their desks at their offices at Stanford, and they called it Google Alpha, and this ran for about 6 months, and finally their professor handed them a check and said, "This is too good. It needs to be a company. You're a company now." So we were founded in September of 1998 when the professor handed them a check. Basically, our goal is to grab the entire web search market as much as possible. We are singly focused on search. As I mentioned earlier, we're not going to become a portal. We're not going to do anything other than search. That's all we focus on 24 hours a day. In June of 1999, we got a big boost, obviously. We got $25 million in venture capital funding from an unprecedented two VCs. Typically, the VCs compete against each other. But in this case, this was the first time ever that Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia Capital both gave money to the same company at the same time in the same round. Obviously, with that infusion of cash, we were able to buy a lot more computers, which made my day a lot harder. When I started in June of 1999, I actually started a few days before the funding arrived. We had 300 computers, and we were doing about 500,000 queries per day. Now we have over 6,000 computers, and we're doing over 50 million searches a day. And that is still growing at a phenomenal rate. And we're still adding computers at a phenomenal rate. And I'm still not sleeping at a phenomenal rate. Our current services, obviously, our homepage, google.com. Go there, search, use it, love it, let me know about it. Web search in general for places like the Washington Post, Yahoo, Netscape. Site search, as I mentioned, for a website that doesn't want to devote any engineering resources to figuring out how to search over their own web space. They can just pay us, and we'll take care of it all, and they don't have to devote any engineering resources, nor do they have to devote any computing resources. It's all done on our computers. We launched our wireless search a few months ago, and it has been going spectacularly well. So those of you with WAP-enabled phones, you should check it out. We have also launched a number of languages. We're over 30 languages now, and you can restrict your searches to one or more languages so that you only see pages. If you want to see pages only in German, you can do that, or Turkish, or whatever you feel like, or most people restrict it to English, or don't restrict it at all. But it's your choice, and we offer that. And then we can do special searches for certain partners. We can arrange with them different protocols so that if they want to have certain restricts, pages that we don't show or that we only show to people within their company, we can do things like that. Another PR slide. Here's our little headquarters. We're located at the border of Palo Alto and Mountain View in the heart of Silicon Valley. Nice little drawing there, which shows about 1/1,000th of the number of companies that are in the valley. But we're located right in the heart, right next to Silicon Graphics and Intuit. And there's not much more to say about that. Here's our boardroom. We like to foster a pretty serious and uptight culture, as you can tell. We offer quite a lot of advantages and perks. State-of-the-art furniture, lots of balls and gymnastic-type devices. We are known for our lava lamps. I know not why. We have over 200 lava lamps. Our lobby alone has about 60. They're all in the Google primary colors, of course, and in fact, they're arranged in the order of the Google logo for cuteness effect. We have a roller hockey league. It plays actually 3 times a week now, which is quite popular. We're only a company of about 140 people, and we have about 50 people that play in the roller hockey league. Our lunch bunch, we actually have two on-staff chefs and an assistant chef. The head chef used to cook for the Grateful Dead. Yeah, that's true. He makes some great stuff for Fridays. Yeah. TGIF is a lot of fun. But we get actually catered meals for lunch and dinner for free at our corporate cafeteria. Very nice perk. Then to work off those meals, we actually have a full gym, and we have a locker room, shower, and sauna as well. We also have two massage therapists, one 2 days a week and one 3 days a week. So those are, this is more of a recruiting slide, I think, than anything else. And like every Silicon Valley startup, we have free food and snacks and sodas and basically everything to caffeinate you so that you can work nonstop. This is something that actually I developed about a year and a half ago. It actually displays current searches that are being done on Google. It's obviously just a snapshot since we're doing, you know, up to or more than, you know, a peak 1,000 queries per second. What this does is it takes a snapshot of 1 second and scrolls it through 10 of those queries, and then it takes another snapshot. And this is just one that obviously you can see my flash bulb. I just walked up to the monitor and clicked on it. This is heavily, heavily filtered, by the way. As most of you probably have read or done, the most popular queries are not what you see on the screen here. Sex and MP3 still rule. They are still number one and two, almost invariantly, except the day after the Academy Awards last year. I missed them. I was working. And I look at the queries, and the number one query was Jennifer Lopez dress. So I can keep current just by staying at work. I don't have to go home at all. Just look at the queries. I'd like to give a little overview of our software architecture and then tell you more about the hardware behind that. This is a sort of a PR slide that just gives you some of the numbers that you can look up in studies, and you can find many different studies and many different numbers, and here are some of them. In 1999, there were estimated almost 150 million web users, and it's estimated to go up to, you know, 320 million in a few years. There are 500 million pages last year and 3 to 8 billion in 2002. That number is actually publicly searchable pages. There obviously has been some talk about the deep web that is not publicly accessible, which could be up to 500 billion pages. Who knows? It's just a guess, really. Right now, it's currently estimated to be about 2 billion publicly accessible web pages. In 1999, there were 100 million searches done per day on all the search engines combined, and that's expected to grow to 500 million in 2002. The challenge of doing this, and there's that 2 billion number that I just mentioned that NEC Research came up with, that is a lot of web pages. That requires a massive amount of bandwidth to download, massive amount of computing power to actually index, a massive amount of storage to actually store all of that information and make it redundant and speedy. And it requires basically a whole lot of computers. More on that later. 85% of users access search engines. Obviously, it's one of the most used things on the web. Most people go to a portal like Yahoo or Netscape, Excite, things like that, and one of the major things they do is a web search and look for information. Obviously, one of the great benefits of the web is the information that's available. Search engines are what give you access to the information that you're looking for. And as evidence of that, MediaMetrics has clearly demonstrated that search engines consistently rank among the top 10 sites as far as traffic to them. Why is Google good? Part of it is that our interface is really clean, elegant, simple, intuitive. For those of you who have seen our homepage, it is our Google logo. It is the text box. We have a few lines of JavaScript which actually put the cursor right in the text box so you can immediately load the page and start typing. You hit return, or you can click on the enter button if you like to use mouse. And then you get your search back, hopefully in less than half a second. Most often you do in a lot less than that. The relevance of our results has been consistently shown as the red PR text shows. we were winner of the PC Magazine Award for Best Web Application for consistently returning good results. Basically, this is due to our co-founder's original code and what has since been improved upon greatly by our fantastic engineering staff of about 75 full-time engineers. The smart hypertext analysis, which I will talk a little bit more about later, really is what gives us this relevance. The page rank that I referred to earlier in the link structure analysis is what actually led to the launching of Google. And that's important, obviously, because when people use us, they get good results. They get quick results. The page loads quickly, and so they come back. And we've ranked first in customer satisfaction and loyalty for actually the last 4 quarters in a row. The slide's a little bit outdated there, according to the NPD studies. I mentioned speed already. Our goal is to keep every search under half a second, and we are actually highly successful at that. The mean search is 0.35 seconds for us, which is actually pretty fast when you consider the over 1 billion pages that we're searching over. And that brings me to the scalability issue. To really scale the infrastructure to handle 1,000 queries a second, which is, again, growing at a phenomenal rate, and an index that is over 1 billion pages and growing at a phenomenal rate, we need to have excellent code that handles this and does this in a very quick fashion, while still maintaining the relevance, not sacrificing the quality. And we also have to have lots of computers. Here's our interface, for those of you who haven't seen it. Again, this is actually the top part of the same slide I did earlier on just typing in Usenix, and it search took 0.06 seconds. A little hard to see there maybe for some of you, but that's 0.06 seconds. Couple things about what actually Google shows up. We have the snippets, as I mentioned earlier, which oftentimes that tells you enough to know whether that's the page you want or not, and whether you need to scroll down a little bit further. Sometimes it's even enough to give you the answer you're looking for if it's a really short answer. This slide does not show it, but we actually group the results. If Usenix had a number of pages which showed up, we indent them, just as these bullets here are indented. So the first Usenix page appears far left, but then the next one would appear indented a little bit. And so it shows you that those are actually from the same site. And if the information you're looking for is on one of those pages, that's probably the site you're looking for. The cached results, I've already talked about. It's a great workaround for dead links. And similar pages I also mentioned. Again, it gives you related links. If you type in Usenix and you look at similar pages, you'll get other groups that are similar to Usenix. The PageRank technology, patent pending, had to file a patent. Once you get VC funding, they hire lawyers. Lawyers file patents, mainly for protective reasons. Because as we've already seen in our short existence, people are starting to copy us already. So although philosophically we are very divided or even against the filing of patents and believe in the open source movement greatly, obviously we use Linux extensively, and so we would like to be able to contribute back code to the community. Unfortunately, at this point, we have to keep some of that proprietary because of business reasons. What PageRank does is it provides an objective measure of a web page's so-called importance. It is a little bit like a popularity contest in that each link is sort of a vote for that web page, but each vote isn't really equally weighted. If a vote comes from a page which is known to be a highly ranked page itself, it is given a little bit more weight. So if your site is linked to from my homepage, that doesn't count for much. If it's linked to from the New York Times website, that counts a little bit more. This makes it highly spam resistant. And as I mentioned earlier, we, with this page ranking, we don't look at just the keywords. And we don't look at meta text keywords or invisible keywords as well. So people can't try and spam us that way, which they do. The technology behind Google is actually pretty well documented. This is just a short little list of a couple papers. They are available, these white papers, on our website, through our website, so you can take a look at them if you haven't already read them. Let me talk a little bit more about what actually happens at Google, or more importantly, at our data centers when you go to Google. First of all, your query goes to a hardware load balancer at some data center. And that is determined, we do global load balancing, so that is determined by where you're coming from and also how the data centers are loaded at that particular time. If a West Coast data center is really killing over from heavy load, even if you're coming from the West Coast, we might shunt you to the East Coast because you'll get better performance. And we tune this on a daily basis to make sure that we're really keeping that sub-second response speed for queries. Once it hits the hardware load balancer, the hardware load balancer's job, obviously, is to load balance across a number of web servers, and so it picks the least loaded web server. From that, the Google web server, which we've written ourselves, it is called GWS, G-W-S, Google Web Server. We're not that original with our naming, but it's short. The web server itself does another tier of load balancing. It looks at a number of index servers and document servers and also a few ad servers as we start to serve up small little text ads. And it determines which of those servers are the least loaded and most capable of giving them the information in the quickest amount of time. And that is all done through our code. It's not hardware related. It's all done in software. Our front-end server load balancing is paired hardware server load balancers, as I'm sure many of you know about and use, for fault tolerance and redundancy. If one of them goes down, the sessions immediately switch over to the backup load balancer and things continue merrily along and queries aren't missed at all. What a load balancer does, for those who don't know, I'm sure you do, they balance incoming web requests and they balance them over multiple web servers. Typical algorithms are round robin, where you just pick server A, server B, server C, etc., and just keep going around. Or you can do it on least number of connections, which is a metric that works pretty well for some sites. If most of your pages are relatively equal in the amount of load that they put on a server, then the number of connections that that server has is a good measure of its load. There's also direct server load, which you can have as a variable, and that could be anything from literally a load that you get from top or a measure of load that the web server itself has. And we've actually written into our Google web server, it knows its own load and how many queries per second it's handling and how many it can handle, and it reports that back to the load, to the server load balancers. And as I mentioned, we do global server load balancing so that we can do it across multiple data centers. And we have metrics for, obviously, people coming from Europe, we like to send them to the East Coast if the East Coast is able to handle the traffic. People coming from the West Coast and Asia, send them to the West Coast if that's the best place. But we have the options of shunting the traffic back and forth as it suits our needs. Query processing is actually extremely complex. One would think that it's actually not. One would think that you pretty much go and look and find the information and bring it back, but it actually involves dozens of servers, mostly index servers and document servers. And the index servers, there are many, many index servers which have portions of the data. Obviously, the index of over a billion pages doesn't fit on a single computer. It is sharded throughout many computers. And then that is also made redundant massively throughout our cluster, which I will get into in great detail later. But the query then goes to a few dozen index and document servers and finds the information that it needs from the index or document server, which is the most speedy to respond to it. Most of the communication goes through our web server. We also, from the web server to the back ends, have both TCP and UDP connections. We use UDP for some of the connections where it just is a very low bandwidth, very low amount of data that is passed, and if we get a response right away, great. Connectionless, so if it's dropped, we'll try again on a different one. So that can really enhance query speed by using the UDP, and it decreases the bandwidth that we use as well. Reliability and fault tolerance are obviously critical for any major website, and especially a site like ours where we need to be up, really have 100% uptime. We really can't sustain any downtime. When we're doing 1,000 queries per second, if you're down for an hour, that's a lot of dropped queries. And people get very mad at me. PCs are what we use, and at this point they are, sad fact to say, they are inherently unreliable. But they are cheap and fast, which is the good thing. And so our strategy has been to exploit this cheapness and fastness and use thousands of off-the-shelf PCs to achieve our redundancy. So we take the data and we split it up across many different servers and replicate that across many different clusters and many different data centers. And so we get reliability and fault tolerance. In the software end, we do that as well. As I just mentioned, we replicate everything. We have many, 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 many copies of the data set. We can lose many, many, many computers and still not suffer any loss of capacity at all. When we lose a real lot of computers, our capacity will suffer in that the response time will slow down. But we will not go down. We will still be up. We will still be serving queries. They just may be a slight bit slower. Our basic principle for fault tolerance is keep it as simple as possible. And this applies to both the hardware layer and the software layer. Because debugging a very large system, when you're dealing with 6,000 computers spread across multiple data centers across the country and world, that's hard enough in and of itself. And then when you have to deal with the application layer and the algorithms behind those, you want to really keep everything as simple as possible so you know where in the chain something is going wrong. And so you start really go right through the front end, you know, router, you know, well, bandwidth provider, their router, your load balancer, your web server, your back-end servers, and the application. And that's the way you do it. We use TCP-based communication channels between the web server and the back-end servers, and that is to ensure fault tolerance. We want a connection full state for that. And so the web server actually sends the query or the portion of the query to the back-end server, and it does this in massive parallel fashion, which is how it achieves its speed. And TCP inherently obviously has that state so that the web server knows if a backend is not responding, it tries a different channel, tries a different server, or tries a different port of that same server. What do we do when a backend server crashes? Either the machine itself or the software. The binary gets out of date, the binary is not there, the binary just dies. Well, TCP, you get a reset, and you send the request to a different channel, as I just mentioned. If the hardware crashes or the software just hangs, we have a very short timeout So we just time it out and we send the request to another machine. What we also do, though, is we periodically try to reconnect to a dead backend to check on their status, because obviously, for capacity reasons, if, you know, 50 computers all of a sudden die, we're not just going to declare them dead infinitely. We'll check every few minutes and see if maybe they come back up, you know, they were rebooted if they needed that, or the binary was restarted, or it got the right binary, whatever the case may be. For backend server load balancing, basically, you only have two algorithm options: round robin over all of the channels to a server, or least connections. And we actually do a mix of both, depending upon what the particular information is we're trying to retrieve, whether it's from an index server, a doc server, or an ad server. What we do with the dead backend is we declare it to have an infinite load, and therefore, in the load balancing scheme, it doesn't get counted. It's dev null. How do we scale traffic? Well, when I started, as I said, we had about 500,000 hits a day, and now we're over 50 million hits a day. So obviously, our traffic has had to scale phenomenally in the last 16 months or so. Replication is definitely your best friend. You want your data in as many places as possible. You want it as highly redundant as possible. Another way is we make our index read-only, so it's not continually being updated, so there are no consistency problems. So if you happen to hit a server on the West Coast or in Asia or in Europe or on the East Coast, you're going to get the same result that you would in every single place. As I mentioned, the search is highly parallel. We send out these queries from the web server to the back ends. If we know we need a bit of information from shard 1, shard 5, and shard 23, we send them out simultaneously in parallel and get back the results so that we get that linear speed up. And we replicate at all levels. We replicate at the web server level, at all of the back end type servers, the entire cluster, and obviously data centers. Scalability of data. Well, obviously, the web is growing exponentially. Numbers I gave earlier show that it's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And those are just guesses. We really have no idea how big it's going to get. But no matter how big a machine you have, it's going to be too small, obviously. And so the solution is to distribute a single copy of that index data across multiple machines. And that's what we call sharding, which is really a good phrase for it. I think it's much better than GIS. Sharding means that you take as much data as you can and put it on one machine and then, cut it off and then start there and put the next shard of data on the next machine and so on until you have a full, complete index on X number of shards. And then you replicate that many, many times. So what this does, actually, if you do the math of it, instead of doing one search over n documents, you're actually doing k searches over n divided by k, and so that scales linearly, which is very nice. Here's our networking architecture. This is our current architecture with the overseas data centers not yet live. Right now we have three data centers, two on the West Coast, one at Exodus in Santa Clara, and one at Frontier Global Center in Sunnyvale. And then we also have another Frontier Global Center cluster in Herndon, Virginia. What we've done to ensure redundancy here is we actually have a private OC12 that runs between Exodus and Sunnyvale. And so if our bandwidth provider at, say, Exodus goes down, our incoming bandwidth goes down, we actually global load balance those queries to go to Sunnyvale, but they actually don't use Sunnyvale because Sunnyvale might be at its peak capacity and can't handle the traffic. So it goes right through the OC12, sort of a backdoor right into the other data center at Exodus. So that's a very elegant way of achieving redundancy. We have the same thing. We actually have a global center to global center routed 2-gig line between Virginia and California, which is quite nice. And that's also used, obviously, for replicating the data set as we do. on the local level, our network looks like this. You have to have a picture of the internet as a cloud. I think it's standard. We obviously go into switching routers. Again, I didn't draw it here, but every network device, of course, is paired. You'll see most of the lines here are paired, meaning that we have everything in a redundant, fault-tolerant fashion. So we have the two routers running the virtual routing redundancy protocol, so if one dies, fails over the other. Probably not news to those of you who run high-traffic websites, but again, if you need 100% uptime, you have to have this. Load balancers, same thing. What we do is the routers then go into these clusters, and the clusters that we've developed generally have 80 machines per rack, and I'm actually going to show you a few slides of those in a minute that you're going to not believe. And we have many, many, many of these. As I said, we have over 6,000 servers in total, and that's growing. And we have gigabit uplinks, multiple gigabit uplinks from each cluster into the routers so that we really have a very high-speed internal network so that our response times are on the order of a fraction of a millisecond to go from one machine to another. Again, that's purely for the speed. We use El Cheapo, that's trademarked by us, PC-based servers. Currently, Rackable.com is the company in California that makes them for us. They are off-the-shelf hardware, anywhere from 400 to 800 megahertz Celeron or Pentium chips, typically 256 megs of RAM. Some machines have up to 2 gigs for specialized functions, but the vast majority of those 6,000 are only 256 of RAM. And we have some 40 and some 80 gig IDE disks. We have all local disk. We don't use any storage area networks at all. We use one IDE disk per channel. And we've actually written a patch to MLOC so that we can actually use both channels at the same time. And that's something that we're looking to contribute back to the Linux kernel as soon as we have it refined. It's not 100% perfect right now. We get about 70 to 80% throughput instead of the 100% that you could get using both simultaneously. A cabinet is 7 feet tall, it's 3 feet deep, and it's 2 feet wide. And we put 80 1U servers in that. That's incredible density. For those of you who've been in colo centers, a typical amount of, you know, whatever that comes out to be in the cubic foot range, typical number of servers, if you're using, let's say, Suns, probably you're going to have 10, 12, maybe 15 if you're getting dense. And that doesn't count the extra space that you use for your extra extranet storage, you know, your storage area networks. So these are 80 machines, all with local disk. They're complete, they're isolated, and they work very well. They generate, one cabinet generates 5 kilowatts of electricity. You can do the math and figure out how many BTUs that is. I'll talk about AC and data centers in a little bit. We have 2 GigE switches per cabinet. We have 2 fast Ethernet switches that go to the servers, so they run at 100 megs, the individual servers, NICs, and then we have gig uplinks from those switches to the backbone routers, the core routers. The reason we do this is not because we want to harass data centers, and it's not because we want to have all these machines generating a ton of heat and overloading Lieberts left and right, but data centers are very expensive. They charge by the square foot, so you want to maximize your MIPS per square foot. Simple math. And we've actually calculated that if you buy Sun and SGI machines to do the same amount of CPU the same amount of MIPS, it's about 5 to 10 times the cost. And we're already paying a lot. So Sun and SGI, really, we cannot do it on Sun and SGI. There's just no way. We couldn't. I don't even think we could afford just the licensing fees for their OS. So we're all Linux all the time and very proud of it. And I say that as a prelude to this slide, which is the one that I'm not proud of. This is a picture I took the day I started. This is the first generation of the high-density servers, 80 per rack. What is a little hard to see here, unfortunately, we removed one so that you could see a little bit more of the guts. This is a 2U space, and it has 4 motherboards, 8 disk drives, 8 NICs, 8 sticks of RAM, and 1 power supply. Yes, ow. Yeah. You can see the lovely cabling neatness. It's neatly color-coded, yes. The yellow ones mean yellow and the blue mean blue. It is also very, very neatly, if you can read the numbers, they really had an elegant naming scheme. They called the top one here, that says G41. And of course that comprises 41, 42, 43, and 44. Next one is G37. So G37, 8, 9, and 40. Okay, so you think, well, okay, the numbers are going up as you go up the rack. Well, if you look down a little bit, you'll see G61. So that's, I don't know where that came. But okay, it looks like they're getting back on track here. G61, 4 more is G65, 4 more is G69. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough space to show what's on the bottom of this slide, which is the next one, which says G93. 80 per cabinet, G93. What you can see here is these are 4 independent reset switches, so you can actually reboot each machine independently. However, they still are dependent on a single power supply, so that if the power supply died, you lost 4 machines, unfortunately. What you can sort of see in the back here is a door and fans. We have a back door on these, and there are 62 fans blowing air over these to cool them. This generation happens to generate only 4 kilowatts, not 5 kilowatts, so it's obviously not nearly as big a problem. But the reason was, as we were starting to scale up from, you know, this was around the level of 300 servers. As we were starting to scale up and realizing that we were going to very soon be in the thousands range, you know, we needed to get higher density with commodity parts to get some cost-effective computing power. Let me show you what's been done since I came on board, and I'm mostly proud of this. Not this slide, this slide. Here's our more recent design, and this is the one that is attributable to Rackable.com. These are off-the-shelf, you know, Intel-based PCs, as I mentioned, and gave you all the specs before. It's not the best of slides, but what it does show you is rack 7 foot tall. There's actually a hood on top that has 4 humongous fans which vacuum up and ventilate the air out through the top of the data center. As you see, there's a fan here blowing air up. And these are tiled vents here. And cool air comes up from the floor, and we assisted a little bit with the fans. The data center is not happy about that, but until they actually start putting some more pressure behind the cool air, we're going to assist it. These machines, as you can see, are all 1U, and we have a switch in the middle. And you can see they're nicely cabled, no yellow, blue mess strewn everywhere. And you can see the orange Gigi cables going to our core routers, which you can't see. They're just off to the right of this person's posterior, my colleague. And these machines, there are 40 on each side. They are half depth. There's about a 3.5 to 4 inch gap, and then on the other side there are another 40. So we get the same 80 density, and the air is blown in. There are fans on the front of these that suck the air in over the CPU and disk, and then go into this central column, which then gets vacuumed out and vented out through the ceiling. So it's actually a highly effective way of getting the AC up to the machines, over the motherboards, and then out. By the numbers, we're doing approximately 1,000 queries per second at peak. We have over 6,000 Linux servers in our clusters. We have more than 500 terabytes of disk storage, and we're doing tens of gigabytes per second sustained I/O at daily peak, and that is gigabytes, not bits. Think about that. That's a lot. I love this slide. We've calculated that one Google day equals 16 and a half machine years. Simple math, 6,000 machines, 24 hours, that's 144,000 hours or 16 and a half years. Now, let's suppose that your average machine has an uptime of 6 months, which for a heavily loaded server, you know, is about right. You know, I mean, we certainly have servers that have been up for, you know, years, and we have some that seem to have problem with days and weeks. PC hardware is inherently unreliable, unfortunately. But if you average a machine dying every 6 months, that means that we're going to lose 33 machines a day. So the lesson from this is redundancy, redundancy, redundancy. I won't repeat it anymore. You need to engineer your system to handle failure. Failure is going to happen. It is a given. Something in your system is going to fail someday. Power. We have blown up Lieberts. We're not proud of that, but we have. There are ways of overcoming that. There are ways of dealing with the phase issues and going from 110 to 220 and having the amperage and things like that. The data center is unreliable. Their bandwidth could be unreliable. They may not cool. We, at one point, actually at two points, I have temperature sensors in all our data centers. At one point in an unnamed data center, it was 93 degrees ambient temperature. Yeah. That is not fun. At another point, it was 62. That is also not fun. Your fingers go numb after about 5 minutes of typing. But obviously a nice, you know, 65 to 68 or even 70 would be acceptable. As I already mentioned, the AC, everyone laughed. Data centers are having problems with realizing that kilowatts in equals heat out. Pretty simple equation. Always true. I don't know where they got their EE degrees. The answer is probably they didn't. But they really don't have the AC to handle our density. They're used to the old model of 10 ultra sparks in the same square footage as we have 80 machines running. So we actually run LM sensors and get the temperatures on all of our CPUs. It's updated every minute on every machine. And we have, obviously, monitoring scripts and everything that look at these and let us know when a machine is getting too hot. We've gotten CPUs up to over 100 Celsius. They generally stop working around 80, 85. Just if you were interested. typically 35 Celsius, 40 Celsius is acceptable. When they get in the 50 range, you actually do start seeing some bit errors. If they're in the 60s, you start seeing some major problems, and higher than that, the server usually dies. The network can go wrong in so many different ways. Those network engineers out there, or anyone who's dealt with a network, know that a switch can die, the cable could be bad, or flaky, which is even harder to diagnose. NICs just, they die. The drivers could be buggy, or stop working. A backhoe can cut through your OC12, or your DS3, or your T1, or your OC192. It doesn't matter. Backhoe will cut through anything. Stupid things can happen to your network. You can lose your DNS. And things start to grind to a halt when they can't figure out how to resolve names. It's pretty amazing how quickly that happens. So again, redundancy, redundancy, redundancy. Multiple DNS servers. We actually load balance our name servers so that you have a single address to go to, and that load balances across a number of DNS servers. So if one of them dies, you're pointed to one that's live. Routing can be a problem, either at your end, your network engineer, maybe even you, could misconfigure the router, turn on, something like spanning tree protocol, or turn it off. Which brings us to loops. Someone could just be at the data center and, want to plug in a device or a new rack or something, and not realizing that there's another connection already existing, and create a loop. For those of you who've had that unpleasant experience of seeing a loop in action, it's pretty impressive. Typically, it happens very quickly. And what the easiest way to diagnose it is, walk in, look at the switches. If they're all lit solid, you have a loop. Unplug something. That happened on my third day. And it was my fault. But I'm still here. I did fix it within a few seconds, but it was not one of my finer moments. Security, obviously a big issue. As we get more and more of these SYNFLET attacks, I won't go into all the various ones that have come out, in the last year, but the script kiddies are out there, and they're out there to get us. We've seen a tremendous increase in the amount of attacks on us as we grow more popular. It's inevitable. Every site sees it. SYNFLET attacks are actually extremely well handled now by the Linux kernel with SYNcookies. They work extremely well. If you're not using them, you should be. In the 2.2 kernel, there is one caveat. In the 2.0 kernel, SYNcookies used to be turned on by default, and in the switch to 2.2, they're not turned on by default, so you actually have to turn them on explicitly. That is an important thing to know, because if you think that they're on, they might not be. You should check that. But SYNcookies work extremely well in dealing with SYNFLET attacks. Obviously, you need firewalls. You need good ACLs, access control lists, on your routers and your firewalls to make sure that the traffic that you want in gets in. The traffic that you don't, doesn't. Your bandwidth could die at any moment. It could be a backhoe. It could be something more simple, like someone at the data center misconfigured their router and took down the link to you. So, again, redundancy, redundancy, redundancy. Multiple data centers, multiple bandwidth providers, multi-home. Failure, they just keep... The modes just keep continuing. The host failure, obviously, the hardware as we know, can fail. The hard disk can fail, the motherboard, the NIC, the RAM. I mean, you know, the power supply I didn't list here, but any piece of it can fail. And it can fail for various reasons. It may overheat. It may just fail randomly, as hardware does. You know, there's a certain percentage failure rate for PC hardware. And we see, actually, we see less than expected, unbelievably. Pardon? We actually see about 4 to 7% post burn in. We actually do network installs at our headquarters of a rack of 80 machines, and then we do a 24-hour burn in test, and we see up to 10% failure rate, which is pretty much the quoted PC hardware failure rate. We obviously then get rid of those, replace them, reinstall, reburn in. Once we get them to the data center, typically 4 to 7% failure rate, and generally that does occur within the first 30 or 60 days of use, as is typical. So it's, I think, just more of a burn-in phase. Once machines are up and running for a month or two, they're usually pretty good machines. But of course, every once in a while, a disk will die that's been running fine for a year or two, of course. The software can fail, despite having, you know, 30 PhDs and another 50 excellent software developers, the code can be buggy. Hate to say it, but sometimes Linux is buggy. We've run into problems with Ethernet drivers. We actually, there was a bug in the, I mentioned how wonderful the SynFlood attack and SynCookies were, but there was actually a bug in that code last year, which Alan Cox was very kind enough. We emailed him in a panic because we were being SynFlooded massively in a DDoS attack, and he responded within 4 hours with a patch, and it immediately stopped it. Immediately. And the interesting thing was he apologized to us because it was one bit that he forgot to check. He literally sent me the patch and said, "Here's the patch." It was one byte, and there was one bit changed. And he apologized to me. I was ready to kiss his feet. You can also have failure at every level of the application, whether it's the web server itself or any part of the back end, the database. The data could get corrupted if the disk gets corrupted. Also, your basic services could fail. DNS, if you're using NFS, which we use minimally, but we do use some. SSH can fail so that you don't have access to the machine. So that's actually a bit of a controversy in my group as to what to do when you can't SSH into a machine, but it's actually working fine. What do you think? I usually wait until trough and then reboot it. Monitoring. Well, we obviously have to do extensive monitoring. What I've learned is that there are no tools out there that I know of, and if there are, please let me know, that can deal with 6,000 machines. I have had to write a ream of Perl scripts and shell scripts to deal with every aspect of monitoring a cluster of this size. But our basic motto as far as these scripts is, if a server fails, you know, just restart it. Don't send out pages. Don't send out emails. We get too many emails. We get too many pages. We don't need to bother to know that one out of our 6,000 servers rebooted. We really don't. Trust me. But we do a lot more sophisticated monitoring. We do performance monitoring in real time. We have real-time stats that are updated every minute that show every single web server, every single back-end server, and the speeds that they're serving the queries at. So we can see instantly when a particular web server is starting to slow down or a particular back-end server is starting to slow down, and immediately take it out of the rotation, number one, first step, so that everything else renormalizes, and then diagnose the problem and figure out, was it an application level problem? Did something get hung? Whatever it was, we fix it. And then obviously when there are critical thresholds reached, it, for us, we actually consider a critical threshold to be if the average query time over a 10-minute period exceeds 0.5 seconds, we send out a page and investigate it and figure out why we're not serving up queries below 0.5 seconds. The challenges with this many computers is, well, they're multiple. Keeping the system images consistent is extremely difficult when you're dealing with this many machines. We recently updated the kernel. You know, not a difficult thing when you're dealing with your desktop machine or your laptop, or even a co-located dozen machines or so. When you're dealing with 6,000, it's a little bit different. You need to obviously do it in a rolling fashion. You don't just reboot them all at once. That doesn't go over very well. The bigger issue, though, is actually what do you do with updates? Because, as I mentioned earlier in our stats, you know, roughly 33 machines are going to be down at any given point in time. What happens when those machines come back up? They might have out-of-date binaries that are incompatible with the current code and start causing real havoc. They might have an old kernel which has a known exploit, and so now we're vulnerable security-wise. That's a very difficult problem. That's something that I work on pretty much every day. There are lots of client-server type ways of dealing with this. You can do the push model, you can do the pull model, you can do the cron job sync model. We actually do all of them. It works pretty well, but it's not perfect. There's still a long way to go. I would really like to see, well, I'd really like to have the time myself to sit down and tackle this problem because I know it in great detail, but I just don't have the time to actually make it work. So if anyone out there does, please see me. We monitored a system state, as I mentioned earlier. We use the LM Sensors package. If you're familiar with that, that's a wonderful package for the Intel platform, which gives you a number of stats, CPU temperature, how the disks are doing, how the memory is doing. It is phenomenal in the amount of information you can get, and you can get in a very short period of time so that we can pull these computers minute by minute and find out how they're doing and catch errors, catch the soft errors. When a disk just goes belly up, of course you're going to notice that. The server is going to start having bad response times or no response times. But with the sensors updating every minute, we can actually catch some of the soft errors and see when a disk is maybe slowing down a little bit or the CPU temperature is creeping up and the machine is slowing down, and as part of the diagnosis or diagnostics, we look and go, oh, well, you know, maybe the thing's overheating. Let's see if we can cool this down. Obviously, you have to monitor the application, and that's actually done all in the software itself. It actually is self-monitoring, and it monitors its own state. And then we also have third-party monitors that we've outsourced that monitor our entire site, as well as a number of scripts that I've written that monitor our site. I have these monitoring scripts that run at each data center and monitor themselves and the other data centers. So, again, redundancy, redundancy, redundancy. For debugging performance problems I mentioned earlier, you have to keep the architecture simple. We start with a base OS. Before I arrived, Red Hat was chosen. For no particular reason, to be honest. And that's what we use. For better or for worse, that's what we've standardized on. We strip it down tremendously and use only those parts that we need. Everything else is gone. And every machine gets the same base install, so every machine should be identical. Then on top of that, if it wants to be, or we want it to be a web server, we give it what it needs to, we've actually packaged a web server package, or RPM, and an index server RPM, a doc server RPM, etc., so that we can make specific machines very quickly and also revert them. If we decide we need more web servers, we pull a couple doc servers and we know how to make them, you know, undock server them and web server them. Very easy. And that's how we track the system and code updates, basically with the base installs and then making everything a package so that it's easily traceable. When you're copying terabytes of data, like we are with our index, you're going to get bit errors. It's a certainty. It's going to happen. Even with ECC memory, there are still unrecoverable errors that occur. So you have to engineer the software to deal with that. You have to do checksums. You have to check all the data before you roll out a new index. You have to make sure that every shard has an identical copy to the master. So what we've learned from scalability, hardware-wise, keep it simple, stupid. The stupid is for me. Basically, keep everything as identical as possible. Know, not only expect, but just know that you're going to have hardware failures. You are. They're going to happen 33 times a day. Cheap hardware, though, does allow us more computation power per query. That's why we chose the Intel platform with Linux. If you're a website that's doing well, which I hope you all are, traffic is going to grow much faster than you think. No matter how much you project, how much overhead you think you need, you're going to need more. You're always going to need more. So you really have to use factor in scalability. And that I can't overemphasize that. You need as much overhead as possible. Obviously, cost comes into the factor, and it's a cost-benefit analysis in the end. And, of course, the CFO and the accountants are going to get involved when I go and say, hi, can I have 30,000 more computers? They're going to probably say no right off. So I'll ask for 15. That's pretty much it.